Hello and welcome back to the Artpuses podcast, a series by Bosler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener, or the viewer in this case. I'm so excited to have an artist I've admired for a very long time, Sakari Douglas Camp. Sakari, welcome to the Artpuses podcast. How are you feeling today? How are you?
I am good. Yes, feeling calm.
Feeling calm. I'm feeling calm as well, which is good. You mentioned that you've had a busy day going around lots of art, the kind of final art shows. How's that been?
Enlightening. Yes.
Really?
BA shows are enlightening because people are being christened into the art world. And so they are very excited. They are euphoric. And it was just nice to be in that kind of shower. Really? So positive. And excited about what they might do next or what they were trying to show in their final pieces. So that was fun.
That's really nice. And do you like that kind of relationship between the, you know, artists at the beginning of their career and having that interaction with them? Is that something, is it inspiring to you in a sense?
Totally. Mm. But, you know, quite unreachable just because, you know, they're so young. Yeah.
So young.
They are so young. Yeah. And you just think, wow. Yes, it was a wild day.
Well, we're going to obviously talk a lot about your life and your work, but I'd love to kind of take it back to your very early life. Can you tell us a bit about where you grew up and what life was like?
Gosh, I grew up in boarding school. Yes, my early life was in Nigeria was so tiny.
Yeah.
I left when I was eight.
When you were eight?
Yeah, when I was eight. So the beginning of my life, I don't know how to describe it, actually, just because it was so so by accident, the beginning of my life, in that I was brought up by my sister's husband. And I went to live with them at the age of five or so. And my sister died, and this man who'd married her, so bereft because he'd lost their children as well as her in childbirth, and he was going to have twins, and he was just absolutely in pieces. So he asked my parents whether he could still look after me because he was all alone, really, and he still wanted to be part of the family. So I had an unusual beginning of my life because I was brought up by a white anthropologist. And then he followed the other people, his peers in Nigeria, because he was teaching in Nigeria. And he followed his peers by sending me to boarding school, which is what you did back in the day. And I was sent to boarding school, and I went to school in Oxford for about 4 years. And then I went to Dartington for, you know, from 12 till 18. And it was incredible.
Really?
Yeah, I had an incredible time in Devon. And then I decided that I was going to go to the States because I wasn't English. And I wanted to have a broad Western education to have a better view of the world.
Yeah.
And I only lasted a year in the States.
Where in the States did you go?
I went to a good school. It was a sort of craft bias school, arts and crafts. And it was called CCAC back in the day. I think it's called something else now. But it was on the edge of Oakland and Berkeley. And it was interesting because I was getting away from England and the English, and most of my teachers at this school were English.
So
I didn't get away.
And what an extraordinary story of your early life. Do you remember how it felt to, I mean, it went through so many changes, I guess, at a very young age. You know, first you moved away from your parents, and then you were sent to a completely different country. How Do you remember that those feelings in of that change? And I mean, it must have been a huge culture shock as well to move into a boarding school in England. Like, how did you deal with it all? Were you quite a relaxed child? Like, what was it like?
I was a very confident child.
Mm.
And I can't say that I liked the school in Oxford because they were a bit backwards.
Really?
Yes. But Dartington was my kind of place.
Mm.
And children are amazing in that, you know, you need them everywhere, don't you?
Yeah.
They don't necessarily say, no, I don't want to go there.
Mm.
So I was quite an easy child, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't have any research on what England would be like. I was even shocked at seeing autumn.
Yeah.
I went around, I was telling some girl today that I went around weeping because I thought the trees were dying and we were all going to die because everything was brown.
Yes,
everything was brown and that was regarded as normal.
That must have been such a shock. I never thought of that.
You know, I'm used to it now.
Yeah.
I'm so used to it, I've used it in my work. So,
yeah. And was it in Dartington when you first became interested in art? Was that the space where you were, you found your creativity? Or was it before that?
Before that.
Mm. What age?
Very young.
Really?
Yes, because this man... His name was Professor Robin Horton, but we called him Uncle because he was Uncle to everybody. Mm. He came from a family of painters.
Oh, really?
Yes, and he'd been told not to paint himself because, you know, the family just didn't want broke people all over the place, I guess. So he was discouraged from painting. He gave me my first paints. Gave me my first tea set and all these things. So I started painting without really seeing the paintings that were in the family.
Yeah.
But, you know, his family were impressionist painters.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they did beautiful work, some of which I have.
Mm.
And I decided that painting wasn't my thing.
Really?
Yes, I just told myself off for the age of 12. So don't do that. You don't know how to do it. And decided that I would be much better with sculpture.
Wow. Even at the age of 12, you already knew
I decided.
That. Really?
Mm.
Wow. That's really impressive because I definitely didn't know anything about what I wanted to do at the age of 12. What was it about sculpture that drew, what about sculpture drew you to it?
It just seemed to be where my hands wanted to be.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because
it was just something that I preferred to painting.
Yeah.
Because the skills of painting are incredible.
Mm.
To create perspective and all of that was an important thing to consider at the age of 12.
Mm.
And I had a dilemma in that my people are a little more Chinese or Japanese in a sense, and that perspective has nothing to do with their psyche, really.
Yeah.
So it's just anybody, any size, plonked on stuff for a reason. But yeah, disappearing into a point wasn't the thing. And if I think I had a Polaroid camera and I pointed out somebody that was in the distance to my mother, and she said, we don't have a midget in the village. What's that? Who is that?
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, there are actually different ways of seeing things. And so I just decided to embrace what I felt comfortable with.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And you obviously go on to study art. Are you working primarily in sculpture that whole, like as soon as you start studying?
Basically, yes, because I like getting my hand into this perspective business.
Yeah.
My hand had to go in there to just make things, draw things out.
Mm.
And yes, I like the tactile quality of working with solid things.
Yeah, no, I can so see that. And what was the when you were studying art in London, you went to the Royal College of Art. Is that correct? Yeah. Mm. What was the art scene like at that time? What were your memories of studying at that point?
My best memories actually weren't at the Royal College. Oh. My best memories were at Central.
Oh, yeah.
Which is now called Central St. Martin's, mm-hmm. but it was a very, very different school.
Really?
Back in the day.
In what way?
St. Martin's kind of sculpture department had, you know, famous artists who wanted to put their stamp on people.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, hell-bent on really heavy steel welding and all of that. And at Central, you were allowed to feel your way. So two totally different schools.
Yeah, that must have been nice.
Yeah, I made the right choice that I wasn't at St. Martin's. It was incredible because it was near the Africa Centre.
Okay.
It was central London and the Africa Centre was in King Street back in the day and right by the piazza, the place where performers kind of throw balls and stand still like statues.
At Trafalgar Square? No.
No. It was like a market.
Oh.
There's a square there.
Okay.
With a church. Mm. But they've built up to it so that there's hardly any square left.
Oh no.
But back in the day, I got artists from Nigeria to actually come and perform in that square.
Really?
Yeah, they walked out of the Africa Centre and they walked into this piazza.
Yeah.
They had drums in the portico of the church.
Wow.
And they drummed and did a little kind of parade run, circular run around this kind of square.
Wow.
And did a public performance.
That sounds amazing.
And then trotted back into the Africa Centre.
Was that for an exhibition that you were doing at the Africa Centre?
I was the resident artist. I was the first resident artist at the... Can't put the words together. The first resident artist at the Africa Centre.
Okay.
And got this grant to kind of bring 17 performers from my hometown.
Wow.
To come because the Africa Centre was this amazing place where writers and activists from all over the world were. Mm. Back then it was, activists against apartheid were in the country and there were a lot of artists.
Yeah.
And people sort of drinking in the bar and giving you free tutorials, you know.
Wow.
So from Central, I had my first few exhibitions at the Africa Centre with tutorials from these already made artists.
Mm-hmm.
Gavin Janjus.
Gavin Janjus.
And Patika Nutuli. Yeah, and you know, I think Ben Okri was around talking about his ideas.
Amazing.
And everybody was kind of exchanging ideas in the space.
Mm.
And so I had tutorials and I put up 5-day exhibitions and things.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That must have been amazing.
It was very useful.
Yeah. Mm. And you obviously work in steel as your main material that you work in, and you create these unbelievable sculptures. I mean, really, from the big ones to the small ones, they're all so beautifully done. Do you remember when you first, what drew you to steel at the beginning?
The death of my father, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Your birth father or your adopted father?
My birth father.
Okay.
My birth father was, died.
Mm.
And you couldn't fly home straight away because Kalabari funerals take forever to arrange.
Okay.
And so I was at the Royal College and I decided that I would make him a wake-keeping bed, which is a bit bizarre. But
what is a wake-keeping bed?
A wake-keeping bed is just a four-poster bed.
Okay.
Because the deceased is put on a four-poster bed that's decorated.
Mm.
Kalahari people love decorating things.
Yeah.
And you had, they decorate beds and rooms. Mm. And once the body's gone, they just keep on dressing and changing the bed. There, there are bed dressers in Kalahari culture that will sort of layer fabric so it seems as if there are waves on the bed.
Wow.
And, you know, beautiful colours because of all the different fabrics that are used and folded to make patterns on this bed, four-poster bed. And it's the sort of a last rite. You know, it's a bit like an Irish wake.
Yeah.
With everybody around, everyone coming to say goodbye.
Mm.
And so I made this bed and I had sort of inlet areas where there were kind of very abstract figures that pushed themselves into the bed. And that was myself and my sisters. And it was kinetic. So we in wakes, we do a lot of singing and stuff with handkerchiefs. So there are little handkerchiefs on these inlet areas that swept the surface of the bed, or and people sort of likened that to crying or doing some kind of expressive thing with these handkerchiefs. And it's owned by the Smithsonian.
Is it?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I would love to see that. It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Is it? How big was it?
Life size.
Really? Wow, what a touching thing to make for your father and for the memory. Was it quite cathartic to do it? Did it feel like...
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had goggles for about 2 months in the studios at the RCA making this thing.
Yeah.
And mourning.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I didn't mourn now that I weld other stuff. But, you know, it was like, you know, people that wear shades.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't. You can't really see what they're thinking with their eyes.
Yeah, that's really moving. And so it was from that moment that you felt that steel was your was a material that you really connected with, or the process that you really felt comfortable with.
Yeah, and before then I'd learnt how to weld because I needed to make casings for motors that I used with my work.
Mm.
So these casings had to hold these motors that made things shiver and shake.
Yes, because so many, especially of your early works, were kinetic.
Yes, they were.
What appealed to you about that? What did you what did you like about the kind of combination of steel and movement?
Well, it wasn't just steel, because I used to work with wood.
Oh, really?
I used to work with wood and hardened material.
Mm.
Just changed to steel because it was already hard.
Okay.
You know, some kind of movement had to happen. There was no reason to kind of fill my lungs with toxic resins.
Yeah.
Instead, I have sooty steel.
Mm.
Anyway, it worked out.
Mm.
I needed movement just because so many celebrations and things that I wanted to describe and show in gallery spaces, things moved.
Yeah.
Things shook. I mean, I think... with Western poses, you know, a ballerina sort of cocks her leg and everyone goes, oh, how sublime. But back in the day, I used to just love the idea of people shaking their bottoms, which is what Kalahari people do, is that they, you know, they have steps that they take, but then they'll bend over and just give you a little shimmer.
Yeah.
And there are all sorts of rhythms that people can do with their asses, like you see on Instagram. But in the 80s, you know, all I could do was show this by making my motors shake.
Amazing.
It was mad.
I guess steel perhaps was considered quite like a masculine, you know, steel welding and quite a masculine, process. Did you find, was there like any misogyny behind that? Did you find that people kind of pushed back against you doing it, or were people very accepting?
I think being a black woman was quite empowering.
Mm.
Just give them a side glance and they'd go away. But I think that was the thing between Central and St. Martin's again. I think at St. Martin's there was a form with steel in that you chose the heaviest girders, then you added a little kind of light bit of steel to this heavy girder-like thing, and that was sort of all very Anthony Cairo, but not incredibly female in any way. And that's probably not the right thing to say, but, you know, I just was very glad I wasn't in that environment.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to push against anything. I just had very, very sympathetic tutors and technicians at Central who, nursed me through what I needed to do.
That's very good to hear.
Yeah, it was incredible. I was very lucky.
That's all it takes, really, doesn't it? Just a few good people on your side believing in you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only believing, making things possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who were some of your, do you remember like who your influences were when you were just starting out?
My influences were old farts. from my guardian, my uncle's academic life in Nigeria, because I was a 60s child and that Nigeria had its independence, and we were in these university environments where people had such belief in the identity they wanted to create being Nigerians, which was a new thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were in the same environment as pioneers, you know, even at the age of nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be taken to parties and stuff, and I'd watch and listen to folk and fall asleep underneath tables and things, because that was the kind of life this man led, bringing me up. And yes, so there were choreographers and painters and writers. You know, even Wole Soyinka was around.
Really?
Yeah, you know, drinking and enjoying himself. Wow. So there was a particular choreographer who did her research by going to villages and things to see what festivals were on. And then she'd bring these festivals back and onto the stage from in the round to something square that could be filmed. And, you know, then I had the idea that I could do the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was kind of very simple, but it was new because we hadn't really described our environments before.
Yeah, that sounds like an amazing kind of atmosphere to grow up in. And
it was.
See. Yeah, very inspiring.
It was amazing.
And I want to talk a bit about, I guess, oil, because I suppose at the same time as this is happening in the part of Nigeria where you are from, oil was starting to be extracted, discovered. And is it a coincidence that you then started to use oil barrels for your sculptures? And what is the, yeah, what is the relationship between oil and the material that you use for your work?
Well,
big question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, from sort of masquerade festivals, which was my attention, you know, to describe Kalabari identity, suddenly the environment came out on top because we had these flow stations dotted all around the delta because we used to live on islands.
Yeah.
My people live on 22 islands that are now being attached to the mainland with bridges and things.
Okay.
These flow stations just would burn gas, you know, in the North Sea. We don't just burn gas. We siphon it off so that we can use it in our houses or whatever. In Nigeria, this stuff is just burnt into the environment. And I was at a dentist somewhere looking at National Geographic, as if I had to look at National Geographic. But anyway, National Geographic did something and that they looked at these flow stations and flaring in the Delta and realised that flaring in Nigeria caused the damage to the ozone layer in Australia.
Oh.
Yes. And I just thought, oh, like you. So I thought, we're not alone, and this isn't Nigeria's problem.
Mm.
It's a global problem because, you know, people are getting cancer in Australia, so far away, and, you know, just plain dying of, you know, bad air and the soot in the Niger Delta. And it just seemed like a really unkind move. So it came into my work rather than festivals. And at the time, I think there was also a man called Abacha who was our leader. And he was clamping down on any political comments about his governance. Yeah, including, you know, helping to kill Ken Saro-Wiwa. And driving to the university on call taught at then, which was in the Rivers State, it was Port Harcourt. There was a man that I think wasn't very well, but he used to write just anything that came into his head. You know, Arsenal, Chelsea, God is great, whatever. But he, his text and the font was always perfect. But he wrote on trees, he wrote on walls, anything that was along the road. It was just a band of writing. And I thought, he hasn't been stopped. His writing hasn't been stopped. And I was just kind of thrilled with that. Sort of graffiti. Graffiti really wasn't a thing in Nigeria. And I used that in my work. And I would fill glass containers full of oil and be carrying it myself because it was just part of my life. Part of my family's life. So from that, my local garage here in southeast London used a lot of oil, and they had spare barrels which they didn't want to pay to get rid of. So they'd ring me up and say, "So, Corey, we've got a spare barrel," and I would go and pick up their barrels because it was free materials, really. Rather than immediately thinking this was the ideal thing to sort of describe the Nigerian situation. But, you know, oil was in the background. Always, even though I was describing totally different things, like lovely Renaissance paintings or something, oil was in the background. So it was quite an interesting signature to use.
And I suppose it kind of speaks to that, to what you just mentioned of like how it connects everyone in the world, the kind of globalized nature of oil and now climate change, of, you know, maybe starting in Nigeria, but then you're using the barrels in the UK, and how everything basically is connected to oil as well.
Well, what was the sort of wake-up call for me was typing in oil into the internet and getting olive oil as well as crude oil, and realizing, you know, it's all about kind of trade. And it's all God made. And we wear it on our lips with Vaseline. It's a petroleum derivative. And we have it in our clothing. And, you know, because you try to be as sort of clean as possible when you realize that things are off. But how off they are is quite intense.
It is. It really is.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Kensara Wiwa, who was a writer and activist who was killed.
Yes.
Very, very sadly. And you created this beautiful sculpture called the Battle Bus.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and also what happened to the Battle Bus?
Oh, my God.
That's so sad.
Oh, my God. Well, I you know, went for this thing because it was a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as an artist, you work by doing competitions or having sales with your gallery or whatever. And I was a little scared of going for this competition, but I did anyway. And I was the winner with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
We were two winners. The other guy didn't get a chance to realise his work because the patron of this exercise died, and that was Anita Roddick.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he was an Indian artist, and I'm embarrassed to say, I don't want to say his name wrong, but, you know, an amazing artist that just had a gobsmacking idea of a type of Twitter before Twitter was invented.
Oh, really?
Was what he wanted to do.
Wow.
Was that we were all going to be able to converse with the Houses of Parliament with some app he was going to create and project onto the Houses of Parliament and buildings all around, you know, shell building and things, just to talk about what we thought was wrong and to enlighten people. So his idea was just amazing, way ahead of his time. And my piece was basically a bog standard bit of welding.
No. No. Not a bog standard piece of welding.
But, you know, my thing was a bit bizarre in that it was a something the size of a Luton Transit. Very, very big structure, but empty. And it was just a shell, but it was a sort of campaigning structure, like, you know, Mr. Trump on the bus, Obama with his bus.
Yeah.
These battle buses are campaign buses.
Mm.
And so, you know, you can imagine it. We had a bit of that with Brexit buses arriving, telling us about immigrants and stuff, parking up and stirring things. Mm. And that was the idea of this battle bus, was that it was going to arrive and inform people, arrive like an ice cream van or a library and inform people. On it, I had Kensara Wiwa as a front banner, and then around the bus, the logo of the bus, like, you know, Trump or Obama, were Kensara Wiwa's words that he's close to one of his interviews that he did before he was killed. And he said, "I accuse the oil companies of practicing genocide against the Ogoni," which was like such power.
Yeah.
So much power that some places this bus went in England, people objected to genocide being used because they came from countries and history that had genocide practice. But everyone's a bit, you know, everyone always thinks they're more special than other people, don't they?
Yeah.
As if genocide doesn't happen to other people.
No, completely.
But anyway, the words were there, and the bus travelled around England for 11 years.
Wow.
And it was kind of moved around to different venues. It was in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
It was at the, at the Arnolfini on the South Bank, in Tottenham. It went to all sorts of places and just sort of sat there. And people did performances in it and spoke about it.
Wow.
And it did a lot of work, but we wanted it to go back to Nigeria.
Yeah.
Go back to Nigeria as a memorial to Ken. And when it arrived at the docks in Lagos, it was impounded. And basically disappeared. And to this day, we don't know where it is.
Wow. It's so sad to hear that, because obviously, but obviously it had a huge impact while it was here. And I suppose also speaks to the same nature in which Ken was murdered himself. And a kind of a reminder of how scared people are of art and of words, and, you know, the legacy of it, I think, will remain even stronger because it's been disappeared, if that makes sense.
Yes.
But it is really, it's a shame because I would have loved to see it.
Yeah.
But I will put some links to it in the episode description so people can have a look for themselves. But it's really a very moving work of art, I think. And you memorialized Ken in such a beautiful way, I think.
Mm-hmm. What is very special that I didn't actually design about the bus is that the lettering, the words were cut into the sheets of steel that made up the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And the words are reflected on the inside of the bus as if it's like a sort of newsreel, except it's a sort of light shadow of the words swimming around on the inside of the bus.
Wow.
And you don't even realise that's happening because you're looking at the outside.
Mm.
But if you just put your eye up to the slits where the letters are, you see the letters just swimming around.
Oh, that's so nice.
And as a sort of wordsmith, which is what this man was, it seemed right that his spirit was somehow writing in that space.
Yeah, no, it's so beautiful.
Mm.
And so, Kari, I think another amazing thing about your work is that you do such extensive research into the topics that you do, that you look at. And so many of your works are this kind of beautiful, I guess, relationship between the past and the present in whatever form they may be. I had the pleasure of coming to your studio and seeing it for myself. And you told me about this commission you had for The Three Graces. Could you tell me a bit about that? Because you spoke so beautifully about it. And I think this... You did. And I think, you know, looking at, you know, I think so much of your work has this beautiful relationship between, you know, a difficult topics of, you know, a colonial past and the present, but how really through research and through art it can be, I guess, dealt with in a new way and allows people to maybe confront it in a different way. So maybe you can tell us a bit about that commission.
It wasn't actually a commission.
Oh, it wasn't a commission?
It wasn't a commission.
Oh, sorry, I got that wrong.
What was it? It was a bit of madness. It was a bit of madness in the studio and wanting to make things life-size.
Okay.
A little bit bigger than life. I had to pitch to my gallery that I had this idea just because I'd been looking at Botticelli.
Mm-hmm.
And I had seen versions of the Three Graces from his painting, The Primavera.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And Cadova, a carver, had done a version of it. Matisse has done a version of these three women frolicking around. And historically, it's just... it's most of the time it's titillating work.
Yeah.
And the women are naked.
Yeah, always.
And my sister-in-law sent me a photograph of herself and two friends just looking just so happy and proud at her son's wedding, my nephew's wedding. And I just thought, now those are three graces, and they've got clothes on as well, you know. And I just decided that I was going to put clothes on these women because I'd seen William Blake's version of these three graces as well, and William Blake's print was called "Europe Being Supported by Africa and America."
Wow.
And I just thought, well, nothing's changed then, is it? And this is from the 1700s or something.
Oh, my God.
And I chose that exact print and the postures and gestures just because William Blake had obviously done his homework as well and was doing an amazing thing with how these three women touched each other and held each other and... your eye followed you know, certain areas in this print. And he had a tobacco plot which held the three together, that was like a sort of wreath which sort of covered the private areas of the European, especially the, you know, two black and brown people weren't really covered at all, but they had amulets on their arms just to show that they were still somehow shackled. When you look at this stuff, you just surmise that, you know, although he was trying to do something about freedom and equality, we still weren't equal, especially as the European was lounging so much on the African and the Indian, American Indian, in the print. And I just thought, yeah, I think I want to make this piece, except in, at the end of the wreath which holds the three figures together, I'm going to put oil nozzles, petrol nozzles, because slavery isn't so much the banter, but oil was for me in the 20th century. So I wanted to sort of illustrate that with these three women. And when it was first made in 2017, hardly anyone said anything about it.
Really?
Yeah, it was at some amazing fair in Olympia in London. And I think people sort of sidestepped it, I guess, because it was black women. And they didn't know what it was about, and they didn't give it a chance either. A curator at the V&A decided that this would go very well with the Africa exhibition that was held there in 2022, was it? 2022 to 2023.
Okay.
Nearly a year. And she decided to put me in the sculpture court next to Rodin and all this kind of Western history. And I still haven't got over it.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you feel when you first saw it there?
Oh, my God. And we wheeled it through the sculpture court, and I thought the statues would turn. What's going on? It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
So they're quite big. They're bigger than life size, right?
Just a touch.
Just a touch. It must have been an amazing thing to see and such an important thing to do. And I think it is. I think the Three Graces is such a nice way of just reinterpreting the same visual and seeing how it changes and how the conversation changes.
Women power.
Women power.
Yeah, not just fannies.
Exactly.
It's amazing. Because, I mean, you know, the eye of people is challenged at the V&A.
Yeah.
Because there's just so many rapes and garrottings and, you know, fannies and everywhere.
Everywhere.
And you just think, are you doing this with a straight face?
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah.
And can you talk just quickly about the clothes that you have on the Three Graces? Because I also love the way that you use, that you kind of weld the fabric, and it just looks so beautiful.
Oh, well, I stretch things a bit with the fabric because from the photograph that my sister-in-law sent me, there was African fabric, which is like a kwete material. And then there was also kind of Middle Eastern fabric that seemed to be influenced by paisley patterns, which originally was something to do with pomegranates, I think. The design was kind of reduced from that to the paisley pattern. And it's something to do with goodness and all sorts of positive things. And then there was yet another bit of fabric that looked as if it was Mondrian-like in the work. And that was for the European. And then you had these two other blocks in the world, Middle East and Africa, in the way the pattern worked. And I cut out steel to make patterns. So my stuff is kind of holy. Yeah. And then I put acrylic paint on it. So it was kind of fresh and vibrant and colourful. And the women had different hairstyles on. It looked almost like sort of a wet look wig and a really long haired wig and head ties. I love gilly head ties. I mean, you see women trying to get out of cars in London, stopping traffic with their huge headdresses on the Old Kent Road to go to various churches. And you think, yeah, how to celebrate Sunday.
So
all of that is in the sculpture.
It's a beautiful
sculpture.
It's
a praise of African women, really.
Yeah, it's lovely. Is it still in the V&A or where is it today?
Today it's in Germany.
Oh, it's in Germany.
Yes. Mm. It's in Germany in a show called The True Face of Africa or something.
Okay.
Yeah. And I haven't been to see the show, but it's meant to be a good show.
Oh, look it up if I'm in Germany. Another of your work, which I think is really such an important and beautiful work, is All the World is Richer Now. And it's this fantastic work. I'm just going to say this quote because I think you based it on a quote by a former slave called William Prescott.
Yes.
And I'll just read it because it is so beautiful, actually. It says, "They will remember we were slaves, but they will not remember that we were brave." Can you tell us about this work, first of all, and what you wanted to say in it? And yeah, the research that you did and how it all kind of made what is a really moving, powerful work.
Gosh. Well, this work is quite old. But we're hoping to cite it in Burgess Park.
Okay.
Yes. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
It's going to be turned into bronze. If anyone hears about it, we'd like support.
Yes.
But All the World is Now Richer is the title of it. All the World is Now Richer, which is a bittersweet title. Just because trying to make a piece about the abolition of slavery is tough. I didn't want to do a sort of piece with some grovelling African begging to be someone's brother with broken chains beside him or whatever, because I think images like that don't make me feel proud. And you know, I'm not a grovelling African. I don't think I need to be that. So it's a kind of reality check piece, and it's meant to be a piece about all our histories. And it's six figures that I put together, which, you know, tell the story of the saga of slavery. You have a man in a wrapper as the first character. And then the next one has a cutlass for cutting sugarcane, which was a profession that created Tate and Lyle. And then you have a slave maid who probably worked in the fields, was a housemaid and a breeding person as well. I mean, you know, probably suffered as much as the men who fell into sugar vats during the process of making these the sugar that was needed for Europe. And then you have a have all these people. You have a Creole woman who is an interesting character because people were repatriated to Africa that were slaves, and they these folk helped to run West Africa for the British because they came from education and were Christians as well, so quite foreign to the West African coastline, but you know, this was all about our colonization. And then you have a businessman, something that people hope to be, a conforming person who has status. And then the last figure is a man in jeans and T-shirt because, you know, the generation, the 21st century of Black heritage don't have to wear a suit necessarily. They can just have a phone and run a hefty business from that. So it spans this piece of work. And it came about because I wanted to be strong and positive.
Yeah.
And I wanted to talk about a history that is all our histories, but has been spoken about from such a warped angle, as if it didn't happen, or it didn't happen as badly as it happened, or so many layers. And the work has a lot of layers, but the strength of it is that these figures stand tall and like bollards, won't get out of the way. And they have words behind them that say, from our rich ancestral life, we were bought, sold and used, but we were brave, we were strong, we survived. All the world is now richer. And these words will be behind the figures, and they'll be made of stainless steel and terrazzo. And my kind of dream is that people will rollerblade on the words, which almost looks like a ploughed field in an abstract way, and walk around the figures. And the site is near a playground, so it'll be viewed by generations and joggers, of course. And I just want it to be in the light. And even if it's in a little park in London, London is a place that you visit and see lots of different pods of culture. Depending on what area you're in, it's almost like that's a separate part of this London place. And I want to make it special.
And it's such an important work, and I really hope that it does get shown in a park, in a public space. You have this quote which I love, which says, let me just find it. Sculpture is a way to stop people in their tracks, because you have to walk around sculpture. And I think the idea of having this work in a park where people, you know, stopping people in their tracks would be so powerful. And I think, like you said, all of your figures are very strong. And I guess steel speaks to that as well. You know, you have these incredible figures, and your work is very positive, and it's an incredible thing. So I'll put a link in there. And if anyone has funds that they want to support this work to be in public, get in touch.
Yes, please get in touch.
We've almost run out of time, but I just wanted to maybe reflect on your career and how you see the future of the arts. You know, you've just met some very young people. How do you think the landscape has changed for them in both good and bad ways? And how do you see your future practice? Is anything different? How are you seeing it?
Oh, gosh.
Two big questions.
Huge questions. How do I see work now? Work is taught so well now that you feel there isn't that much experimentation going on, but there is. It's just that I don't recognise it.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, back in the day, I think we just used to experiment with gook and all kinds of peculiar things. Now there's new materials.
Yeah.
From the gook. Not only that, we have AI that can, you know, influence what people produce, and that people are using data as a material. I mean, you know, data that doesn't know how to deal with different information and gets upset if you take it to a different environment, and you can actually illustrate that by printing out the data, and there is a variation just because the data literally sees one way, and in a different environment, it's puzzled by what it's seeing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of fantastical material is out there to be seen in art. But what is quite disturbing, but very useful to the young artists that are out there, is that they've been trained to make money.
Mm.
We were never trained to make money. So I think a lot of work is quite commercial and is always kind of made for hotel rooms or something.
Mm.
You just think, well, what's going on? But the artists that manage that are able to pay their rent.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a totally different world. You can't go and sort of get benefits really nowadays.
Yeah.
Totally different world.
Mm.
So there's opportunities in that the work that I saw today was about caring.
Mm.
So although people want to make money, they want to make products that care.
Yeah.
And I just thought that that was rather incredible. And thank God.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everything is so automated.
Yeah.
Even our feelings, you know, going and having therapy for an hour or whatever. What is that? You want therapy all the time.
Yeah.
but, you know, an hour is what people can afford.
Yeah.
But this, if we have care all the time, even with art, that can't be a bad thing. And my future, oh my word. Well, my future, I love the idea of maybe, you know, going and doing residencies in other places and actually making work that I don't have to store.
Yes, I remember you talking about your storage issues.
Oh, my storage issue. I mean, because I still have a little bit of energy left to make large work.
Mm.
So I want to go to different environments and just make a large work and then run away and leave it behind.
Yeah.
You know, the last piece I made was last year and, you know, made a piece of work that was titled Peacetime.
Peacetime.
Hey. Yeah.
Tell us about that work.
Well, you know, because we don't stop.
Yeah.
And this piece is a chair.
Mm.
I made a chair and it came from my lover's garden, actually, just sitting in his garden and being at peace with myself.
Yeah.
And I thought, wouldn't that be nice to make? So I made a chair and I have maple leaves above it, seeming like sort of maple branches, which is a very beautiful leaf. And you can sit, because this is a life-size chair.
Yeah.
And it's sited in a playground in Japan.
Mm.
And you can look at the hills.
Heaven.
And just sit quiet.
Yeah.
It's a very understated work, but it's quite emotional with the literal bombarding of the world that's going on.
Yeah.
I think about it and think, yeah.
I've seen pictures of it and I have imagined myself sitting on that chair because it looks so tranquil and peaceful. So it's a lovely concept. And so, Kara, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been such a joy to speak to you. And it's just so fantastic to hear about your work and about your process. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. And for listeners or watchers, I will put some links to Sakari's work in the episode description. So check it out. And if you're enjoying the podcast, just subscribe wherever you listen. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.